is a very technical guy, and he's able to fix all sorts of things and
David
create all
Buckland.
Sorts of things on the site that I wouldn't have been able to figure out. So I really appreciate that. But in this context, it's more relevant to mention his deep spiritual realization and also his extensive knowledge. He has a blog called vidya.ca, and it's sort of a play on words because vidya means knowledge, and his name is David, so it's Da Vidya. And it's one of the kind of blogs that I actually read regularly, in detail, every time he posts something, because I always learn something new. So I won't take up any more of his time, and I'll just turn it over to David. Thank you.
I'm taking the opposite approach from Rick. I like to organize things, and I'm analytical, but in this case, I was called to just go with the flow here. So I'm going to be talking about stages of development in consciousness, or stages of enlightenment, you might call it. There are some people who consider talk of stages to be delusional, that there is only one awakening, for example, or that concepts of stages are a barrier to living them. And actually that's true. Any concepts we hold as truth without experience is not founded in reality. They're just concepts. And so we don't want to be identifying with the concepts, but at the same time, those concepts are like a map for the road. And you deny a person the map for their journey because they might get caught by the map. Confuse the map with the road. You know, it depends on the approach you want to take. In my case, I work on the map. And there's three reasons for that. One, again, is you know, people are on a journey, they want to understand how things are unfolding. And in a broader sense, that it might be outside the teaching that they've been involved in, they may experience it subjectively quite differently than that teaching, or they may be outside of any tradition. Another reason is if we want to do scientific research on this thing, we need to have an actual working framework so we can put things in context. Otherwise, it's kind of blobbing things together that don't belong together or things that are seen the same that aren't. For example, at one stage, it's not uncommon to experience the world as illusory. At another stage, it's not uncommon to see the world as never happening in the first place. Those sound kind of similar, but they're actually totally different and several stages apart. And where on the other hand, you hear somebody describing an ego death into no self, and someone else describing their ego expanding to become cosmic, they're actually describing the same process, just differently, subjectively. So this is where having an appropriate framework is really valuable. And finally, just putting text in context. So, for example, you read the Upanishads or the Gita or something like that, and you read different things, and you hear this teacher saying this thing or this teacher saying that thing, much as the examples I already gave, and they sound like complete contradictory things. And it's not actually that they're contradicting necessarily, they're actually quite possibly talking to a different stage. So understanding the different stages allows you to put the old text in some kind of context. First, though, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes to put the larger perspective in context and talk about childhood development. So put our own development already in some kind of context, so then we understand what I'm talking about better afterwards. So this first stage, I'm going to be using the Alexander model here, but there's also the example, if you're familiar from psychology, I have the example of the Piaget stage. And on the far right is what's called the kosha, which is means sheath in Sanskrit. And it's the Vedic idea of the layers of our being, physical and so on. You'll see how that unfolds. So the first stage that unfolds when we're born, between that first couple of years, is we're focused on the body, basically. And ana, kosha, means food body, literally. And we're focused on learning to walk and talk and make sense of our environment. In the second stage, from 2 to 7 years, that often starts with the terrible twos. We move into our emotional body, and it becomes the dominant area of development where we're experiencing emotions in a much fuller way, and desires, the I want thing. You know, when you see the kid in the grocery store, I want it, and they have to have it, whatever they see. That's because that's really dominant in their perception. And energy healing circles and that kind of stuff, that's what they refer to that as the energy body. Some people will say astral or something like that, and prana, you've probably heard of prana or chi, that's the prana body. The kosha, the chakras and that kind of stuff function, the surface level of that is in the prana body. The next level of development happens when kids start school. They move into the mind, the brain shifts into more of a beta format. Now, in the first two stages, one of the interesting things that's going on, too, is what's called synaptic exuberance. The brain is making massive connections. It's just like an information dump. It's just taking in all the information it can. But what starts to happen now in this stage is that those connections are pruned. The connections that are used regularly are reinforced, myelinated, it's called. They're insulated with a layer of fat. And so it makes them faster and more efficient, but those connections that aren't reinforced, aren't used, fall away. And that's one of the reasons, for example, we start to forget what happened before we were 5 or 6 years old. So there isn't those, the memories are actually still there, it's just that we're no longer have an easy connection to them. And then in the next stage of development, through the teen years mainly, the intellect comes online, the forebrain, the executive functions, higher thought, and so on, and it has the corresponding kosha as well. And then we have the feelings and intuition that develop, and so on into, and then the individual ego and blah blah. But what actually happens in here a lot is that most people stall out somewhere in their development in the mind or intellect level. Levenger's ego development refers to self-protective, conformist, or self-aware stages. And, you know, you meet people all the time that operate from that a lot. And that's basically somewhere in this range they become identified, and they stall out. So they don't reach what Maslow called self-actualization. They don't get down into these stages particularly. There's some development happens, but it never becomes fully expressed. And there's two reasons for that. First one, we don't know who we are. We're not experiencing pure consciousness or the being inside. And secondly, unprocessed experiences or traumas and things like that, things we're resisting. People will often detach from their emotions because they have an unresolved garbage in there. And so what that basically does is identify us with those higher levels and cause the fog that blocks the deeper levels. Down at the bottom there on the right, you can see ananda, which means bliss. In other words, what that means is we have a bliss body all the time with us. But because of that noise in those other bodies, the fog, however you want to describe that, it's not available to us. But as we develop spiritually, those values become clearer, and then that becomes available to us, and then we have happiness for no reason in the background. So the main solution then is two things: essentially, becoming aware of who we are, and becoming and purifying our physiologic healing, however you want to look at it. And the primary way I would suggest this takes place is by this. There's a few different names. There's over a dozen different kinds of names for this. Samadhi comes from yoga. Another word for this is just pure consciousness, the experience of just being in within, or simply that I am conscious without content. Turiya is a Sanskrit word more from the Upanishads that literally means the fourth. And put this in context, we all experience every day waking, dreaming, and sleeping. But there's a fourth state of consciousness that science has been exploring that has a distinct physiology. And samadhi or turiya, that stage. And in that, again, it's a pure conscious state. We have a deep, restful state. At the same time, the mind is alert. And we have this inner clarity without content. presence is another word. So by culturing that, using techniques to culture that, then we're able to bring in these two aspects, Atman and Sattva, otherwise known as consciousness and clarity. Now, here I'd like to mention a little bit about Ayurveda. There is a what's known as the six bhavas in Ayurveda. Bhava in this case means house. So it's basically six areas of life. And the idea from Ayurveda is the Vedic science of health and medicine. And in the first three are the areas of life we bring forward from our family bloodline, from mother and father and so on. The other three are what we bring forward from prior lifetimes. And the key part there is Atman and Sattva. In other words, they're cumulative. Our spiritual development in prior lifetimes is brought forward into this lifetime. And this is one of the reasons you see people who have seven spiritual awakenings with no apparent practice or background, or you have people who have a lot of subtle perceptions, see angels, or have energy healing abilities that spontaneously arise. These are from the two aspects. And the ideal path, of course, is one that develops both. And you'll see why in a moment when I get into our next part, into the core of the talk itself. This is known, the stage of enlightenment are being referred to as trans or post-personal stages of development, because we're transcending the ego and developing in consciousness itself. Yesterday we were at Sophia University nearby, Palo Alto, doing a large panel discussion with that Rick hosted, and that university specializes in transpersonal psychology. So there's basically, in this context, there's stages in consciousness and stages in clarity. They're a little bit blended together in some systems. Like you may have heard of the seven states of consciousness model that was taught in TM circles or some other kinds of things like that. This separates out those states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, from stages of development. But it also is enhanced, this comes out of the Yoga Vasishta, which is the kind of core teaching out of the center of the Ramayana. That's a text from some 7,000 years ago. Again, a discourse between a sage and an awakening avatar. So the first stage, most of you will be familiar with in some way, is known as self-realization or cosmic consciousness. And this is when we wake up from the ego self, the individuality, into our cosmic nature. We shift from being the self, or the me self, the small self, to the large self. There's a number of ways people talk about this. Buddhists tend to frame it more as a shift into no self, as in not the not me. Whereas on the Vedic side, they talk about Atman, or consciousness. We recognize ourself as consciousness. Now, this isn't something that happens to the person. We actually wake up from the person. So no one actually ever gets enlightened. We actually transcend being the person. I mean, we still have the person, and some people talk about this in a more monkish, denial, renunciate kind of approach, but most of us are householders, and in that experience, we still have a person. Everybody you see, the greatest sages, they all have a personality, preferences. There's still a person there. It's just it's no longer the center. It's just an aspect of themselves, like they've got fingers and toes and a person. And, it's no longer who they are. Who they are is expressing through that. So that's the primary stage and the most important one. We're at a non-duality conference, and there's a lot of people that refer to self-realization as non-duality. And there's one of the ways that's experienced is that the outer world is an illusion. And so it's irrelevant, and I'm experiencing this inner unity. But if there's a separate thing, even if it's illusory, it's still separate. There's a duality there. It's not oneness. So it's important to understand this a little better from that context. If you actually want to understand what non-duality is, you're going to have to see where this goes. The second stage is when we recognize that same self within in the world. In other words, we see the world is myself. We recognize that, and that's where you get into, Rick mentioned the Upanishadic saying, so I am that, thou art that, all this is that, that alone is. So in other words, I am that, and all this is that, are both true. So we're, and this is really quite literal. the unity process tends to take place in a series of stages, because there's a progression of essentially experiencing and becoming. What we experience, we recognize we are, and it becomes part of ourselves. And it's sort of this progression that happens through the layers of experience, and then out into the layers of memory and time, and sort of layers of how that develops, and until you have this increasingly larger wholeness or completeness, all of which is myself. And so including what Rick referred to, including all of the universe, and then all of creation, which includes all the universes, it all is part of myself. And that's directly experienced. And it's also on a very literal surface level as well. For example, if you, in the senses, if I touch an object, I experience the object, you know, I experience feeling the object, but as I am the object as well, I experience being touched at the same time, simultaneously. So as you might gather from that, it's an extremely intimate experience because you are everything. It's quite a whole talk just on one thing. But the next stage is what's known as Brahman, or beyond consciousness. And in this stage, what happens is that through this progression over time with unity, we reach a place where consciousness has become aware of itself, both globally and at every point within itself. This accumulation has created this wholeness that is complete recognition of consciousness. And what can happen then is consciousness can recognize all of itself, and then it no longer needs to look in on itself. It knows all of itself. And so then it can turn and look beyond itself. And then consciousness, and from a unity perspective, consciousness is eternal, unchanging, infinite. But what you discover with the Brahman shift is that it's actually another kosha, that I mentioned earlier. It's another layer, and there actually is an origin to consciousness within Brahman. And so Brahman is an aura of Brahman, whereas in unity, consciousness is an aura of itself. In the Brahman shift, Brahman becomes an aura of itself. And there's no, you know, we can describe them in a way of the dynamics of consciousness. In self-realization, we become the knower, the observer. In unity consciousness, we become the observed as well. So we become both. They collapse together, and it leaves only experiencing, the process of experience, the devata value. And then in Brahman, that too is merged. So the actual the fully non-dual state is Brahman, because even in unity, there is a subtle duality of conscious and non-conscious, of being and non-being. It's very, very subtle, but in Brahman that is resolved as well. Now this is a fairly typical process. We're looking at stages in development of consciousness. And quite common in the West with dominant minds, less heart development. And some people see that as the process. But in actual fact, there's this whole other side of it. That if we culture that sattva, that clarity more, along with consciousness, along with that process, then it unfolds a whole different set. Rick made some references to that. The first stage of that is known as refined cosmic consciousness or God consciousness. Because in that first stage, we become aware that we are not the doer. We are the observer of the person doing. We kind of take a step back into this witness or observer mode and see the body and the mind thinking and the body doing and all this going on, but we're not doing it anymore. We're the non-doer, we're the observer. So what then is the doing? And that's what unfolds in refined consciousness. You become aware of those laws of nature, the mechanics of nature, and what's actually causing the body to function the way it does, and all the intelligence that's inside the body and inside the objects around us in the world. And the key aspect of the stages in clarity is refinement of perception and the awakening heart. So in some traditions, they refer to these as the masculine and feminine aspects of development, the absolute and the relative sides. And the fullness of the process is in both. So they're also known as Shiva and Shakti. So this is the Shakti process now. And the next stage. here, is refine unity. Now, one of the interesting things about this process, too, is that with the stages in consciousness, they begin with a realization, a recognition, and then shifting our sense of who we are, shifting being. And this completely changes our perspective of ourselves and of the world. And so each of them begins with this distinctive realization. And then in the refined stages, though, it's a slightly different process that's interweaved with it. And rather than starting with a realization and then maturing, it's a progressive process that peaks with God realization, where we actually, in higher unity, where we actually become the divine. Now that's a whole process we can go into, because there's a choice that takes place in there as to how your relationship with the divine shifts. But it's a quite a profound process. Now, for some people who have been leaning heavily on the Shiva side, on development of consciousness, there isn't a lot of this going on. And so it's not until later on that stuff starts to show up. Other people, the stages of clarity begin before the first awakening. So people start to become aware of subtle aspects and nature of divinity and intelligence in the world. There's a real range in how that shows up. And also because this is expressed, it's much more personalized. Because we're talking about subtle levels, if you think of the earlier slide as childhood development, we're talking about mind and intellect levels, that the intelligence that exists on that level is made of mind stuff, essentially. And so it can be whatever it wishes to be in terms of appearance. So, I mean, you classically see angels drawn, they were portrayed with big wings, for example, and flowing robes. This is what's called personalization. Our culture, our expectations, and the intelligence's desire to appear a certain way is how they appear. But what they actually are is underlying that. So it's the appearance is the appearance. It's not the reality. The reality is what's underneath that. An angel experience purely would just essentially be a cloud of intelligence. But because of it's much easier to relate to a form, people will personalize it. They'll experience in the way they expect, or they'll present in a way that might be expected. So it's an important understanding of that process, because it gets really confusing when people get into this angel looks like this and like that, and there isn't those kind of angels. It's this kind of angels and all kind of stuff. It just depends on. I mean, it's an incredibly vast field. And it depends on what people are specifically aware of, and the dynamics and the relationship to it as well. Some people are much more in the intellect. They don't get into the personalization. They stay with the impersonal process, and so they don't experience laws of nature as beings. That's not where they want to go. They just stay with the principles. They just learn the understanding and processes that take place. And then there's other people who quite commonly will experience it in various kinds of forms. Then you've got refined Brahmins, where that process continues. And each time what happens is all of this, when you shift from into unity, all of the process that took place in here goes away. It's gone. And then it gradually comes back into the new context. Because this is a complete change in sense of self and being. And so there's a process for that to become established, and a process for this to come back into that new context. Because these are quite distinctive. Brahman is known in the Vedic text as the Great Awakening. It's considered the largest shift of all of them, and they're actually progressively greater. I mean, this one takes a bunch of stages to fully develop, and this one is even bigger. And so essentially you develop this place. If you're taking this full path, you come down into here, and there's this whole rich thing where you have this intimate relationship with the environment, everything you look at, if you choose to observe it that way, you see the flow of consciousness within it, you see the flow of life and how it operates, plus the physical form. It's all there available to you, just kind of, it's like shifting focus, what you're looking at. But then you come, and there's this profound intimacy with all those things, because there are myself, right? But then in this stage, it's gone. You dump it all. And now it's a more impersonal kind of stage, where I mentioned earlier near the beginning, where not that the world is illusion, but it was never created in the first place. And it's like there's an appearance here, but it's like it's a brief thought in the mind of the divine, but it actually was never created, it never unfolded. It's just like this idea. And everything we experience is just this really simple idea. It doesn't mean it's illusory, it just means it's not what it appears to be in the sense that we understand it. The final level is what's called Parabrahman. I don't know if anybody talks about that stuff at this point. Part of the working on this model for me has been speaking with many dozens of people who have shifts. Sorry about that. I've actually been present for several dozen people who have gone through these stages, and while they were actually having the shift, and then also I've talked to many people afterwards, or I've read accounts and that kind of stuff, and it layers into this nicely, so there's a lot of detail that expands out from this. For example, with the first shift, self-realization, there's five different ways that people experience it subjectively that can sound quite distinctive. For example, there is a sense of shifting from the ego self into the cosmic self, into Atman, into consciousness. And that shift out of the ego can be experienced as an ego death or just an ego surrender. It kind of depends on how that process goes. There's also the sense of shift from a me self into a no self, into a nothing or an emptiness, where the first is more for shifting into a fullness, the other one's shifting into more of an emptiness, primarily because there's less of clarity. So it's more flat and simple. A third style is where the person experiences their me ego sense expanding to become cosmic. And again, these are just variations in subjective experience. Then there is the devotional surrender. All of these require a surrender of the self in some way, but it happens when, not because we do something, it happens because self wakes up to itself here. The cosmic self wakes up to itself through this apparent form, and that allows the awakening to take place, and that so the ego falls away as a result of that. So it's not something we control or do, it happens through grace, through Brahman. And the final type is what's been jokingly called the oozer. And this is somebody who gradually shifts, and the shift happens, but it's kind of quiet and uncertain, and gradually over time there gets to be more clarity, and then at a certain point it's just like, okay, this has never gone away, it's here, I have the symptoms. One other thing I should mention, though, there is occasionally a variation on that that gets confused a little bit sometimes. Sometimes one of the characteristics I mentioned of the first stage there, self-realization, is the witness, so there's shifting into the observer mode. That can actually happen before self-realization. There is a stage where people can shift into the witness mode but not become self-realized. It's an energetic structure. I won't go into the whole dynamics of that. But it's there's an energetic structure that supports that, but essentially development reaches a certain point and pauses just before awakening so that the physiology can clean itself out more, so the clarity can increase before the actual awakening takes place. Let me see what else I cover on here. Oh yes, another one that's really useful to understand. There's a number of factors that affect the way this is experienced, but one of the interesting ones is the dominant guna. Guna is a word from the Vedas that means quality, but essentially the idea is that everything we experience around us in the world is composed of the interplay of three fundamental qualities. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Sattva, the stages of clarity, is a reference to that. Tamas basically is what we would call inertia in the West. Rajas is like action, fire, transformation, and sattva is purity or clarity. And essentially, if a person has a dominant tamas, when they have an awakening, it's not as common, simply because there's less clarity, but it can happen. There tends to be more rigidity and intolerance, fundamentalism about their shift, and this my experience is the experience, and you know that kind of approach. Then you get the Rajas dominance, where the world experience is an illusion. So that's an effect of the transformation from inertia into sattva. And then the final stage is sattva, and that's when the world shifts into lila, the divine play. So the key point there is this idea of world as illusion being related to self-realization. It's actually related to the guna development. It's actually related to the other side, the stages of clarity, and how far along that process is. And it's different from self-realization. It's not about the stage of consciousness. It's about this parallel stage taking place that informs how that subjective experience is happening. And each of these stages also, of course, has their maturities. Rick mentioned Satchidananda, absolute bliss consciousness, that's self-realization when it's fully matured. Quite often what happens with initial self-realization is there's the liberation, the sense of boundlessness, the inner peace, and that comes along. But the bliss may not come right away because there's still more clarity needed. There's still a fog in the physiology. So over time, as the physiology is cleaned up and that, then the bliss can shine through from the bliss body I mentioned prior. Parabrahman is kind of like that for Brahman. It's like the ultimate, but it gets so ridiculous to try and describe it because it's sort of like the Tao that can be described is not the Tao. It actually gets that as you go down, it gets worse and worse that way. But particularly in Brahman, because you're now functioning beyond consciousness, as it mentions, it's then in this place where it's really fundamental. And from an experiential aspect, it can be extremely abstract at first. That stage itself is quite commonly experienced in two stages. First, there's the experience of that shift out of unity. So the first part of the shift is the loss of that intimacy and oneness. And then the second part is when we recognize what's here instead, a deeper settling into it. So it's a big one. It's interesting a friend of mine was quite devastated by that shift when it happened. Whereas for some other people, it's just kind of like you can fall into a flat period after this great richness. But again, these are parallel processes. So sometimes what happens is this begins down in here or even down in here. So another important point here is that these stages are stages of development in consciousness. We go beyond consciousness here. So the stages of development in consciousness, the atman side of development, is the end of that process. That is when it actually completes. However, the stages of clarity and refinement are essentially indefinite. Because if you just look at something like the Yoga Sutra, the third book, and the kind of abilities that are said to flower, or the potential you see in any number of different stages and stuff like that, and what they've discovered over time, it's quite clear that it can take, essentially hundreds of years for that to develop in our current time. So it essentially becomes an indefinite process. Another interesting thing I wanted to note about this stage too, I mentioned before about the awakening heart. There is, of course, we have our physical heart, and you've probably all heard of the heart chakra, anahata. But there's also this other level of the heart called hridaya, which is in the same physical position as the heart chakra, but it's at a higher level, a higher kosha. And so it's what awakens with God consciousness when that comes around. And then it's basically, we've got this, we've become like a divine pose. It's like this outpouring of love through that becomes a channel for the divine to flow out into the world. So I was kind of skipped around on a few of the details in there. I think I've covered one of the main points I wanted to mention. There's certainly lots of other details. I'm working on a book about that goes into a lot more of the detail on some of these variations and how intense the energy is and how much purification is going on, whether there's more clash going on with this process, and or not, and so on. But does anybody have any questions? Lots of minutes, yes?
I know what you said at the beginning about the truth and the non-truth of this linear description, but I wondered if you, in your book, are you going to talk about correlating this with the 49 levels of linear equation or anything like that?
No, I'm not as familiar with some of the other traditions. My main study, I have a graduate degree in Vedic science, so that's kind of my main leaning, the framework I've used. It's one of the few traditions that actually covers this whole territory, a lot of them only cover parts of it. But there are certainly other ones that go on. From my own perspective, I view the Kundalini process as a supporting process to embody it, but not causal. It's the consciousness itself that is what structures the process. So, I mean, you can certainly do techniques to help culture Kundalini, but that is not going to actually create the circumstance. It's just going to help. It's going to help on the clarity side, so that when this side develops, it will be smoother and clearer. So that's one of the things. I mean, some people have this idea that I'll wait until I'm enlightened, and then it'll solve all my problems. But actually, that's not how it works. Because what's here doesn't go away. It's the same, you still have the same life, they're still the same person with their strengths and weaknesses. It's just now the context is different. It's a part of the process. I didn't go into it too much, but it's a part of the process, particularly related to the refined stages. You have to be a little careful with this too. Some techniques try to push Kundalini, and that's kind of like an effort to try and make it happen. And that's a little bit hazardous because you can fry your energy, physiology doing that.
I'm taking it half-half. Maybe we should both sit there and the people can direct questions to either of us because
sure.
We said we're going to do that at 12:30.
Yep.
And so
sure. Yeah,
come
on. You want to use this mic?
Oh yeah, I'll use the yellow one. You have that one. Here's the chair for you.
I don't know if I'm going to sit down because people can't see me.
Oh.
But, yeah. Okay, yeah, sorry. And that's my website.
Turn the projector off.
Oh, careful. Or we can just stand to the sides. Okay.
So, direct your questions to either David or me. Dan?
So, David, I'd go back to Asher's question, which is... Yeah, I think it would be useful if you compared those maps, or if you look at in Buddhism, there's the Brahma Viharas, and there's the development of the Prajna, the Paramitas, the six Paramitas, and the maps are really very different than this map, and there are places where they overlap, but there are places, what I'm trying to say in a nice way is there are blind spots in this map. From my perspective,
What I'm looking at here, just to understand, what I was looking at with this map is the underlying process.
Yeah.
There is huge variation in the subjectivity and the emphasis that the different traditions and different subjective processes will experience. This is just in the variations on the energy experience, for example, whether it's mild, medium, or intense. Some people are very aware of a Kundalini process taking place. Some people are not aware of a Kundalini process taking place, and until basically lights come on when you get up to the sixth chakra. And some people are waiting for a Kundalini awakening when it actually happened in their past life, and they don't need to do it again. So they don't have that they won't need to do a Kundalini awakening in this lifetime. So it's kind of a vast diversity in the process. I would love to compare more, but I don't want to just sort of take an article online and just list them and sort of say, oh yeah, this is this and that, because that's not the level of expertise I have. I have consulted with several teachers about the Kundalini process, though, because that wasn't part of my early tradition, and I wanted to understand that better. I do have an understanding of the various traditions there and in context in which they fit here. But yes, there's a number of others that could. And you've got to be careful not trying to shoehorn in things that aren't quite the same, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
They said that they'd like us to do this without the amplification because the audio guys need to shut that down so people could move up toward the front if they want to keep it dialoguing and asking questions and you can just sit here and talk to them.
I'm a little bit confused about if everything's consciousness, how can you go beyond consciousness in your life? And then wait, this is the second part of my question. Because you're describing your friend there who, I guess, was disappointed with that stage or something, and I'm thinking, well,
they're only disappointed for the first couple of weeks. Just
disappointed there. He's gone beyond his ego.
Well, it's not. It's, you've gone beyond the ego, but the ego doesn't go away. It's just it's not who you are anymore. So that function is still there.
Yeah.
And then actually, there's some. You know, my experience has been that people actually become more distinct, more unique in their expression because all the sort of supposed do's and shoulds and musts fall away over time. And you're left with a much more unique person. I mean, there's a lot of really monkish kind of teachings that are floating around these days in the West. This denial of the ego and but that's a renunciate approach. It's not a householder's approach. And the ego doesn't. There can be an experience. I mean, for myself, there was experience of ego death. But what I realized over time was that it actually had happened is the ego identification collapsed. And there was a whole bunch of story and blah, blah around it that kind of shattered, and I described it as shrapnel falling away. But the actual, the person was still there. It just, the person, I call it, is still that person there that has preferences and so on. But the Brahman thing, this is mentioned, I mean, she was, she found the shift itself into Brahman devastating, but it was just the loss of the unity. But a couple of weeks later, after that settled out, she then was able to see what was there already, and it was there now. And it's actually even better. I mean, that's why it's called the Great Awakening. It's an even bigger thing. It's a good thing. It's just a might be a bumpier transition. Did I
have
sorry?
But it's beyond consciousness.
Yes.
The part that confuses.
Yeah, because it knows itself. Now, the thing about everything being consciousness, that's a reality in unity. In self-realization, we experience ourselves as consciousness, but the world out there is illusion or it's whatever. You know, it depends on how that's being experienced. That might be expressed as the divine, but we don't recognize it as consciousness, and as we know it as consciousness. We might have a concept that it's consciousness too, but the actual direct experience of that happens in unity when we recognize that the self is behind everything we experience as well. It's all happening within consciousness. And then in Brahman, we go beyond that too. And we just become the knower of Brahman. And it gets hopelessly abstract to try and describe it. Because it's none of what was there before, but it's also all of it simultaneously. So you're both in ignorance, in self-realization, in unity, and in Brahman simultaneously. It's all true at the same time. It's kind of this collapse of all the paradoxes.
It takes a while to get used to this sort of way of thinking because many people have a sort of black, white, on, off concept of awakening, and they're not used to sort of parsing out all these strata and gradations and stages of its development, you know, figure out if you're awakened or you're not. And then you're kind of like, you know, trying to define all these subtle things.
Well, yeah, it's like I talked about earlier, the map, because when you get to a place where this is unfolding for you, then the idea that there's an awakening and you realize the self and that's, I mean, that is the end of the seeker. There can be a really strong sense of being done. And that's perfectly valid. But it's not the whole picture. And there's actually, in the seventh mandala of the Rig Veda, the sage Vasishtha I mentioned briefly earlier, he mentions the importance of desiring unity. And what I would add to that is the importance of knowing that it's there. Because we're not going to desire it unless we know it's there. And in some of the modern dialogue, that whole conversation is missing. But there is people who are having this process a lot out there, and they're looking for places where they can find it. Anybody else?
Alex,
are
you adjusting your glasses, or is that a question?
The book is written. I'm now in the editing stage, which which is always takes a little time. And one of the challenging things, the book's been going on for a while, and it's one of the challenging things is I've been growing and changing. And so the completeness of the picture has been growing and changing. And so the book kind of keeps on. I started off actually with a really much larger project, but it turned into this massive 400-page thing. And I realized that was a mistake, and I broke it up into smaller pieces. And then it was like, well, that part isn't quite clear yet. I'm not quite ready for that part. But what can I write about now that I have the full picture? And so essentially the book is on this stuff in a lot more detail. But it's not the whole all the detail you need necessarily unless you're in the middle of the process. The main thing you need is the overall picture, just to understand that there is this process of unfolding, and that is those two parallel processes. And this is like, you know, from before. I think I may have forgotten to mention in that first slide, one of the points I wanted to make about that with childhood development was, if you look at the chart, you see it's progressively inward development. We go progressively inward, and then if you add the triya, the samadhi, the consciousness to that formula, then that continues, and that consciousness starts to unfold to itself. You get into transpersonal stages. It's a natural progression.
I think Alex had a question.
I got a question.
Maybe I'll wait. Okay, somebody over there, I just saw water over there. Sure.
You mentioned that the Kundalini yoga could help with the clarity aspect of the structure there. Is there anything that could help with the consciousness development aspect?
Well, the key with consciousness development,
it's a spontaneous thing. There's no control you have
over. Oh yeah, we don't have control over the awakening, but you have control over the preparation. So the ground is best prepared. And so that second slide after childhood development, where I talked about Turiya, Samadhi, that's the key. And from my perspective, an effortless meditation is the key, because that gives you a reliable Samadhi experience. Every meditation, pretty much. And so it cultures that, and over time, like they've done a lot of longitudinal studies on this kind of stuff, and over time people start carrying consciousness in as little as 3 or 4 months. It starts to develop slowly, but clearly. And in that process, because you get this really deep rest, and the body settles quite deeply down, the purification will happen spontaneously. Just like when we rest at night, the body is able to release, process its day and release some of the backlog. In a samadhi, a deeply settled meditation, we're much more deeply rested, so it allows a deeper level of purification to take place. Now, quite often, I would say, some of the teachings, they sort of say, oh, my meditation, that's all you need for enlightenment, but most people need some supplementary help. I mean, my experience, I don't have any experience with Kundalini yoga, so I can't say that's the way to use. But I can say that you do want to do probably some supplemental energy healing of some kind with somebody that's decent. It's not, I mean, the kind of thing where they're kind of, move your energy around a little bit or put some light in where it's a bit shadowed. That's very primitive. There are people around that are much more effective. Kristen Kirk, one of the people speaking here, would be one example of that. And so it's a matter of supplementing. And the thing is,
he said that Kristen Kirk said she'll be speaking at 2 on
November. So one of the she doesn't have this framework at all, by the way. She doesn't. I'm just mentioning her because she has that skill set. Also, where I'm going to go with that, this thing is just that balance of culturing the masculine and the feminine, not putting all this emphasis on trying to get out of the world, but that culturing of the quality of life is going to improve your day-to-day life as well in the process. It's not just about the goal, some thing out there, it's about your life right now. And so if you're culturing, your physiology for a better experience of the process with the actual shift, you're also improving your quality of life in the process. Now, and so that's where it's both are useful.
I'm still trying to frame your approach to this book and your work in this area. So if your questions come up, you look at other traditions, because of course immediately I'm thinking of Daniel P. Brown 30 years ago, he his map was 18 stages, and he overlapped a number right. of traditions, looked at them, so...
Yeah, there's a number of synthesizers. Mine is based on the Yoga Vashishta from long ago, and I separated out the consciousness and self aside to make that clearer. So this is like a thing that was developed about 7,000 years ago, and it's stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned, dozens of people that I've worked with and their actual experience of what's happening in unfolding. Now, there's a lot of subjective variation. Some people have a much drier, simpler unfolding. They speak quite simply about the process. Some people, there's this whole richness, and they're like Ilya Kristin, she'll probably make reference to being, she's consciously aware of all those koshas and all the beings that live on all those koshas and works with them all in her healing process. So it's a totally different reality from what a lot of people have yet. But because consciousness is growing, it rises, it's the one consciousness, it's rising group consciousness. So it's rising everybody up as more and more people become enlightened. And it's really started to accelerate in the last decade or so, and a lot more people are having those awakening experiences. But it's also, one of the things it's doing is it's an inside-out process. And so it's pushing stuff that hasn't been resolved to the surface. So there's a lot of noise going on the surface right now. And if you look at world events going on, what you see is circumstances arise to push different kinds of rights into people's awareness, different kinds of conflicts and unresolved things. And, you know, of course, it depends on how people respond to that. Some people get into big conflicts and battles, and they're fighting that change. But if you understand that this is a process of revealing and of purifying on the global stage, then you can see that it's the one consciousness is doing the same thing as you as an individual in your spiritual practice. The whole world is going through this spiritual practice process, through an awakening, you know, however you want to frame that. And so there's this purification process taking place, as well as the deepening simultaneously. But because a lot of people aren't conscious of that process, some people are fighting it and making it worse. And but also it's just they're not understanding what's going on, and so it creates more discomfort and so on. They're not cooperating with the process.
So the second part of my question, finish with my question.
Okay, sorry, okay.
No, that's yeah. Okay. So you mentioned either Susan Crook Gretcher or Lovinger, one of the other.
Lovinger, I'm familiar with.
And so do you have any interest to, since the whole world now is involved with this, yeah. and we have this level of communication, yeah. to really kind of move this beyond a particular wisdom tradition in terms of language?
I use the Vedic terminology because it's there. As I mentioned, some terminologies don't have the language for this stuff. I use the term beyond consciousness. That's not the traditional thing, but it was not the perspective I was taught of in my tradition of what Brahman is. But that's what it actually is, and it's a way to think about it in English in a much more sensible way. I have been moving more and more out of that, but there is still language there. We don't have an English word for sattva. So I use clarity, but it's not quite the right word. Because you start thinking, am I pure? You know, I know I'm not pure enough for this, but it's got nothing to do with that kind of superficial, what you ate for breakfast or whatever. It's a much deeper kind of clarity, and one that has been developing for many lifetimes. You wouldn't be here if that hadn't been going on. This would hold no interest whatsoever. It would be meaningless.
Yeah. How does one reconcile the uncomfortable feeling when the Kundalini is awakened?
Well, I'm not a Kundalini expert by any means. I understand the process, but for me it wasn't. It was I basically was unaware of it until the lights came on. So, but I have a past life history with practice. And so for me, it happened to be smooth. There are traditions that are very helpful with that. Kundalini Vidya, if you're familiar with them, kundalinicare.com, I think it is. Joan Harrigan was one of Rick's previous interviews.
Joan Harrigan, I did an interview with her a couple months ago on Snapchat.
She has a really excellent book she's written. She's both a PhD and the current lineage holder of the tradition, and she understands the process. I mean, my approach to what I talked about with samadhi is different from hers, because she does have that kundalini leaning. But in terms of you know, a spiritual emergency or, you know, a current a difficult kundalini process, they can certainly help with that, because typically there'll be some pranayama or some asana that will help smooth out a process. It can be difficult for people, though. It depends on how it shows up. It depends on what kind of, you know, blocks are there to, that has to be pushed through, how willingly you participate in the process. Sometimes it's we give ourselves more problems if necessary. Yes?
I don't know how the word is. I came from upstairs to make your talk, and I'm wondering how off base some of the questions also going on here you think might be. In other words, it seems like they're looking to math and observation and measurements and theories to define consciousness, and you're here like sort of mapping the awareness of awareness itself, which makes a lot more resonance with me. I don't know.
Well, there is a real strong cultural bias towards what's known as materialism. Like this whole effort to explain consciousness by brain function. And yes, our state of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and sleeping, and samadhi as well, are all functional. There's a physical correlates in how that process works. But, I mean, aside from things like, when I talked about synaptic exuberance and the change in the way the brain is growing, but it doesn't have a real direct bearing on whether we're a teenager or we experience the world as an adult. That's more a process in consciousness and energy. It's a further along. And because of that materialist bias, there's no acknowledgement of that. It's you know, what was her name? The neuroscientist who had the stroke, Jill Bolt Taylor. Really interesting experience, but she completely misunderstood it because she took a completely brain-based, like the cause of the experience, took a completely brain-based approach to it. I mean, certainly the stroke created the circumstances for that to happen, but it wasn't the direct cause. It's not because the stroke caused the consciousness to change. It was that it allowed the consciousness to come through. You mentioned, Rick mentioned in his talk about a childhood fever and then having an experience through that that allowed that to take place. Peak performance, seeing a beautiful sunrise or whatever, also influences that kind of thing.
Sexually, drugs.
Well, it's also actually worth noting that people think of this as a really difficult kind of process that's, you know, impossible, but when you change states of consciousness from waking to sleep to dream, that kind of stuff, we actually go into a neutral gear each time, very briefly, but we actually step into consciousness itself each time we change states of consciousness. And when our mind falls asleep in deep sleep, our ego goes to sleep too. Mm-hmm. So, like, we lose our ego every night. We touch consciousness multiple times every day. And even just in a moment where we just, like, exhausted or we have a revelatory experience or something, just an openness, there's going to be some quietness there can be some a wave of peace, wave of happiness, that kind of stuff. Just these little brief moments come all the way through. The reason we need techniques is simply to help culture that, culture the ground to make it more available. And then we could just be happy with for no reason. But one interesting thing to mention that is kind of interesting. The bliss is also not something that just turns on. There's a section in the Upanishads, I can't remember which one off the top of my head, but they talk about the 10 stages of bliss that steps up, and each of them is 100 times the previous. 100 times. So it's exponential. And so it's kind of funny because what can happen in that process is when something clears in the clarity process and something opens up, and the bliss comes online, it can come online like gangbusters, it's like a blast. There's a joke that you hope it doesn't happen in public because it's like you just rendered a blubbering idiot laughing and laughing and crying and everything all at once. But then what's really interesting about that also is that within an hour or so, it's normal. You adapt because it's part of who you are and part of us there. It's just the physiology gets kind of like poof, and then it kind of settles right in, and then it becomes the new normal. And of course, there's certainly the variation. You get really tired or troubled or whatever is going on in your life. It can become more background or more foreground. but still it becomes part of who you are there all the time.
About the breath, when the breath stops. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that?
Sure. In samadhi, when we go into a deep place of there not being any content in consciousness, we're just in consciousness itself, just sitting there, we're alert, but there's no thinking going on, and the body is settled, is very in a very deep state of rest, then there's no longer a need for breath. So the breath will spontaneously stop. But it's interesting, as it goes longer and clearer, and it gets clearer, you'll notice that actually the lungs change mode, and they kind of go into this vibration. And so they just kind of very quietly vibrate, which is synced to pranava, if you're familiar with that, the fine vibration from which creation arises. The om, pranava mantra, but actually that's another thing that's screwed up. It's not actually om, it's aum, A-U-M, is the pranava. And the letter that's used, the symbol used, actually even in the science non-duality logo, is actually a um, U-M. They've used the Hindi letter instead of a Sanskrit letter. So it's kind of one of those really messed up kind of things. And it's important because that's the purity of that. Sorry, I don't think.
What are your thoughts on psychedelic awakenings? And have you studied people that have gone through that process and how that relates to everything that you've talked about in the process?
No, I haven't studied the process, but I am certainly aware of people who where that's been a part of their process. I know one person who woke up during an LSD trip, but it took them 10 years before they were clear. I know several people whose lives were destroyed by a bad trip. So it's, from my perspective, it's playing with fire. It's an attempt to get something quick or speed up the process. But that clarity process I was talking about, what drugs do is actually they fog up the physiology. They actually go backwards. So you may have some really cool experiences. It may be some nice openings. But the consequence is you decrease the clarity. And so you then need more to get a similar experience. And it's a kind of progressive thing that's actually taking you away from what I was talking about with that. So it's not a path I would recommend. In the yoga tradition, potentially it speaks of different ways of development, and he mentions that herbs and things can be used to create abilities and have experiences and stuff, but doesn't recommend that process. He recommended what's called sanyama, which is a combination of being in samadhi and at the same time being able to have a clear thought and intention. And so then basically it's a simple, it's the third book in the Yoga Sutra, is basically just a list of formulas. If you're able to sit in samadhi clearly and then introduce a thought and of a specific kind, then you have that effect. And so then you can know knowledge of the movement of the stars, past lives, whatever like that. Most of that stuff, though, tends to develop spontaneously.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're thank you. Oh, sorry, we've got to get pushed out.
Sure.
Quick one?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned this kind of effortless meditation in terms of practice and also possibly some energy clearing and other tangential support.
Yeah.
What else do you recommend?
Well, that's the primary stuff, and living a reasonable lifestyle, and you take care of yourself. I mean, of course, we all want to have a good time and have some chocolate here and there. But just a reasonable, moderation is one of the principles in yoga, not extreme, and not, doing things greater than stretch you out and create, greater quality. Effortless meditation, things like TM is an example, Chopra's technique is also those kinds of things. It depends on what resonates for you, what feels right for you, but they can be very effective. But it's also one of those things where you have to be careful. If you've been a long-term meditator, sometimes you can fall into ruts with it and not be quite doing the practice right. You kind of drift into, habits of daydreaming or whatever like that, and then you're not really culturing it. You want to be sure you're doing the practice correctly and so you're culturing that clarity.